Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Professional Responsibility in Legal Education Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, September 29, 2017, during a special CLE teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Ethics CLE teleforum call for 2017. This afternoon, our experts will discuss a number of recent cases and regulatory developments in the legal field. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. A special note for listeners who signed up to receive CLE for this teleforum. At this time, I would ask that everyone signs in using the sign-in link sent to you this morning. Even if you signed in earlier, please sign in again in order to verify that you are here at the start of the call. This sign-in is necessary to prove that you have listened to the entire call and it is time-stamped. During the call, you will hear two unique program codes. One code will be given out at some point during the call, and another code will be given out at the end of the call. Both of these codes must be noted on your certificate of attendance, which you also received through a link this morning in a confirmation email. You'll need to send in your certificate of attendance and CLE evaluation form within 15 days of the call. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Professor W. William Hodes, Professor Emeritus of Law at Indiana University and President of the William Hodes Law Firm, and Professor John S. Dzienkowski, Professor of Law and Dean John F. Sutton, Jr., Chair in Loring and the Legal Process at Texas Law. I will turn it over to Professor Dzienkowski to get us started. After his opening remarks, we will go to Professor Hodes' opening remarks, and then we will go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Professor. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. My first topic today for the first 10 minutes of the presentation will be unauthorized practice of law limitations on modern lawyering. And I'm going to talk about four aspects of it. And I'll start with a recent Colorado case decided in August of 2016, where a Colorado lawyer helped his Minnesota in-laws on a condominium dispute. And what the lawyer did was he communicated with the condominium's lawyers, and he said, I'm representing my in-laws in this dispute. Please contact me. He sought to negotiate a judgment that the condominium association had gotten against his in-laws. And all of a sudden, there's this question of, can a Colorado lawyer do this across the telephone, across the email, in the state of Minnesota? And what happened was that the case went all the way to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and the Minnesota Supreme Court held that the Colorado lawyer had engaged in unauthorized practice of law and issued a private reprimand. Now, they don't issue the lawyer's name in the opinion because of the light sanction they gave him in terms of a private reprimand, but they go through in great detail sort of the Model Rule 5-5 that was passed about 15 years ago, where we have lawyers can practice out of state when it's reasonably related to something in their state, if they can expect to be admitted pro hac vice, or if the association with local counsel, which of course this lawyer might have done if it actually had gotten to a more litigious stage. They found that because the condominium association had a judgment that it was already pro-judicial proceeding, and so it was unlikely the pro hac vice would be applied. It was unlikely that the lawyer would be brought in, and that's why they found that he violated unauthorized practice of law rules. Now, bad cases and bad facts make bad law, but this case stresses Model Rule 5-5, and it brings up the whole idea of what happens with lawyers working out of state physically. And how do you apply unauthorized practice of law rules? And there was a panel at an ABA Center for Professional Responsibility meeting that addressed some of these issues. Could you work in your home office if it's different from the state and where you're licensed and from your law firm location? What happens when you go on vacation? What happens when clients move out of state? Can you follow those clients and still handle work that crosses over multiple states? And the view on that panel was that 5-5 is outdated in this modern internet world. And This lawyer was representing relatives, obviously his in-laws. It was a pretty basic legal issue. They, of course, knew that he wasn't licensed in Minnesota. It does smack a little bit of protectionism, which an authorized practice of law has that feature, but it certainly raises questions that many lawyers may be crossing those lines and maybe subjecting themselves to UPL without being aware of it. You did have an old case from North Dakota where a Minnesota lawyer was helping a North Dakota car dealer sell the dealership. And in that decision, the Rantham versus McCarney, the Minnesota lawyer received a fee for the work done physically located in Minnesota, the state in which he was licensed, and was denied a fee for the work done while in North Dakota. And so you have had these issues before, and they come up in various contexts, such as the idea of what happens when you're trying to collect a fee and your client's the one that's raising the unauthorized practice of law rather than the bar raising it in the disciplinary context. You have many lawyers where laws applied from other jurisdictions like New York commercial law or Texas oil and gas law, and some of those lawyers are called in for contracts and parties located in states in which they are not licensed, and those issues are also brought in of to what extent is that individual interpreting their own home state's law for that contract engaged in UPL. The UPL issue also comes up in the virtual law practice area. There's an Ohio ethics opinion that approves the concept of a virtual law firm without a physical office, with Ohio lawyers working in Ohio, but they do raise the idea that it's possible that an out-of-state lawyer could have a systematic and continuous presence in Ohio through the internet. And so when you have the idea of virtual law practice, where your clients are contacting you through the internet, through portals that you set up process documents, to send over information about the case on an intranet or on a cloud system, you have that whole issue that could a virtual law practice that spans lawyers licensed in different states create problems through this continuous and systematic presence language in Model Rule 5.5. And Model Rule 5.5 prohibits a lawyer from holding himself out, of course, as licensed where they're not licensed. Those geographical limitations are carefully monitored in that whole 5.5, and virtual law practice could stress that in the way the Ohio opinion hints. We also have UPL issues in some modern referral services that lawyers have sought to engage in. There are a lot of services on the internet. There are a lot of startups in California and other states that are trying to pitch to lawyers the idea that we can serve as your portal to a prospective client base. And an Ohio ethics opinion, 2016-3, looks at some of the ethics issues when you use one of these online referral services. Now, some of them are subject-based, family law, immigration law, bankruptcy law. Some of them are broader. They could sought to distinguish an elite group of lawyers in a more narrow category across different practice areas. And of course, the major issue in these referral organizations is how do you compensate them? And when you start to compensate them through per client obtained or a part of the fee, that crosses over into some of the problems with respect to referral services. But the Ohio opinion mentions the idea that if the referral service gets too much information about the facts, if it processes this is the kind of lawyer this client needs, perhaps the lawyers are involved in this non-lawyer referral service in helping them practice law, helping them involved in the practice of law, and that could also cross over the idea of unauthorized practice. Historically, of course, lawyers have been involved in the directories like the Martindale Hubbell or law.com, but a lot of organizations, even LegalZoom, even some of the sort of the more narrow practice area organizations or the publications like the super lawyers have kind of sought to create this sort of referral network, and lawyers seeking clients are likely to want to get involved in that. But the whole idea, of course, is if you expose these organizations to too much of the facts, too much with the prospective clients, too much with the kind of law that the UPL could be raised. We also have an issue with respect to reciprocal referral agreements. So you have a lot of non-lawyer professionals, such as accountants, financial planners, stock brokers, that have relationships with law firms that service law firm clients, and these reciprocal referral agreements are permitted under 7.2. And some of those non-lawyer providers also could engage in quasi-legal services. They could possibly provide forms. They could possibly provide advice that has legal implications, and that's an area where a lawyer could be assisting a non-lawyer in one of these referral agencies. One of the last topics that I want to address in my last few minutes here is non-law entities getting involved in the practice of law, and lawyers working within those non-law entities. One set of those non-law entities are these alternative legal service providers, such as Axiom Law, where they provide managed legal services to corporate clients. Axiom Law has 800 lawyers, 600 non-lawyers. They service many of the Fortune 100 companies, and they provide legal services in conjunction with the risk that a client undertakes when they address a legal problem. And in these managed legal services, they work through the general counsel and they work through the supervision of the general counsel. And that is viewed as possibly taking away the unauthorized practice of law, as the general counsel hires this non-law firm, Axiom Law, C Corporation, organized in Delaware. But lawyers within the company are clearly providing legal services to their corporate clients. And that, again, is another edge. In studying and writing about Axiom Law, I heard that four or five bar organizations brought UPL complaints against that entity and similar entities. Nothing ended up in a published opinion, but it certainly is one of those things that lawyers involved in those need to be careful of. My last point highlights a development that occurred within the last 10 days. The PricewaterhouseCoopers law accounting firm opened a law office, a law firm, ILC Legal, in the District of Columbia. Now, we had Ernst & Young that fostered a law firm, McKee Nelson, and McKee Nelson was a tax firm with two lawyers that did extensive work in partnership taxation and corporate taxation, and it eventually became known as McKee Nelson Ernst & Young. And the relationship between Ernst & Young and McKee Nelson was not well known, other than that there was a loan, there was some back office provided by the accounting firm. That was sort of a captive law firm that Ernst & Young clients got sort of preferential work. But when they went out of state to New York and other jurisdictions, the other jurisdictions were quite irritated that Ernst & Young was in the name. They were irritated that there was a relationship, and eventually that firm merged with another firm, and Ernst & Young no longer had that. The PricewaterhouseCoopers development is first to serve out-of-country clients, international clients, on international legal work. D.C., of course, has an exception to Model Rule 5.4 that lets non-law firms and non-lawyers own a law firm, and that's what they're doing, and that's a very interesting development. So the lawyers in that firm Are they crossing over and engaged in UPL? That's something that will certainly be interesting to follow. I'll turn it over to Bill for his first topic.
Okay, thanks, John. my first topic is on lawyer advertising. I've renamed it. It's been a long time, but we may be on the cusp of serious reform in lawyer advertising. I started with realizing that this year is the 40th anniversary of Bates versus State Bar of Arizona, 1977, and the signs are indeed that this may be year, maybe another year in which there's going to be a major readjustment in the formal regulation of lawyer advertising, at least in a lot of states. Not solicitation, not in-person solicitation, but advertising of all kinds, including targeted mailings and print and online and so on, that may be on the near horizon. Now, for many, I don't know, can't see the audience, I don't know how old everybody is, but for many, it's hard to imagine that before 1977, it was just plain unethical everywhere in the United States to advertise at all. You could go to the country club, you could have Martindale Hubbell and so on, but you couldn't do commercial advertising. Now, there wasn't a great deal of enforcement activity in this because most lawyers came into the profession with a cultural bias against advertising that was passed down to them, so they never really thought about it. They had no precedent, no examples to follow. And so there, it was prohibited, but it was just sort of self-enforcing. But as in the 1960s, early 70s, as the lawyer population increased quickly and dramatically, as small law firms morphed into neighborhood clinics, there were both competitive pressures beginning to build up, the public service component of law practice, or the idea of serving the public as well as, you know, making a decent living, those increased. And so the reticence of lawyers to advertise, to take advantage of, there wasn't all of the electronics we have today, but the beginnings of just more opening up of the technology, that began to break down. And so there were sort of much more deliberate testing of the limits of these rules against advertising. And Bates was the main breakthrough case. It was a major part in and of itself of the development of the commercial speech doctrine in the Supreme Court. The Central Hudson case was only 3 years later in 1980. The main consequence of all of those developments from several other cases through Bates, through Central Hudson, was that the government, and of course that includes the courts doing the regulating and establishing disciplinary rules, those are the government as well, that the government has the burden of justifying restrictions that it makes even on commercial speech. It's not as fully protected as political speech, but it is not at all unprotected. And the Central Hudson framework, which still stands today, is that as long as the activity that's being commercially advertised is lawful, the communications are not misleading, the government can only regulate if it has a substantial governmental interest. It doesn't have to be a compelling state interest as in political speech. A substantial interest, the regulation will directly advance that interest, and the regulations are well-tailored, something pretty close to the least restrictive means, not the single least, but as little regulation as possible. Now, over the years, states have taken a stingy view of Bates and have played a long game of, you could either call it cat and mouse, or maybe whack-a-mole is better with the federal courts. They'll pop up a regulation, and then 2 or 3 years later, the federal courts will knock it down, and then something else will pop up. And it is also the case, because of this, they're all local and they're popping up everywhere, that state-to-state variations, and this ties into John's first topic, that there is such a, there's so much interstate practice today, yet the rules that are applicable are so different everywhere, that it's a major, major problem. The state-to-state variations are nowhere more pronounced than in advertising regulations, and that's become a problem, not only because there's more interstate practice, but because there's more online advertising, which will tie into my second topic. Now, it's not much of a secret that regulators building on or taking advantage, if you will, of some of the looseness in both Bates and the Central Hudson case, cheated a little bit by wrapping themselves in the flag of the integrity of the profession or public confidence in the judicial system. They would just lay that out there as a mantra and said, oh yeah, we have a substantial interest. It's the integrity of information, the republic of the profession. The republic will fall if we don't do this, and so on. And then secondly, it is a well-known, not very well-hidden secret that although there was always a wave in the direction of we got to protect clients and we don't, you know, want to allow lawyers to overreach and so on, in fact, the regulations have a markedly anti-competitive effect. Again, a tie into what John talked about a few minutes ago. And on closer scrutiny, it turns out that all of these highfalutin governmental interests that are being flaunted out there is usually little more than, well, it's undignified and it's unbecoming a lawyer, which cannot hold sway, or it's distasteful. And then on the second side, on the anti-competitive side, it is well known that virtually all complaints that are made against advertising lawyers come from other lawyers, not members of the public. And that's the proof of the pudding, that it's really lawyers trying to shut down other lawyers who are being too successful at advertising. In any event, in 2015, the Association of Professional Responsibility Lawyers, known as APRL, APRL, proposed a huge reformation and simplification of the advertising chapter in the model rules. APRL has been around for about 25 years and has very good traction in the ABA. It was incubated by the ABA Center for Professional Responsibility, has a good working relationship with the NOBC, the National Organization of Bar Counsel. And so I think there is some real likelihood that these are going to be moving forward. The ABA is now officially taken on this project. And the heart of the proposal is very simple. It simply eliminates essentially all of the model rules, except for solicitation and so on, that are now there, folds everything into a single model rule 7.1 with a lot of the comments enhanced, taken from some of the other eliminated rules. And the proposed text is as follows, very simple. And you can hear the strong echo of, for example, SEC regulations, Federal Trade Commission regulations, and it is as follows. A lawyer shall not make a false or misleading communication about the lawyer or the lawyer's services. That's in the current rule. A communication is false or misleading if it contains a material misrepresentation of fact or law, or admits a fact necessary to make the statement considered as a whole not materially misleading. And that last phrase, depending on what your practice area is, will not be unfamiliar with you. Very quickly, to close out, if adopted by the ABA, and then much more important by lots of states, this will eliminate all sorts of Mickey Mouse about that we now have about how big the font size and what color and can you have sound effects and what are comparative statements and how do you have to prove them if you state something. But there nonetheless will continue to be legitimate arguments, just as there is in the FTC regulations on about what is and was not misleading. And I'll just give one example of that and then turn it back over to John. I'm very much a pro First Amendment guy, want a strong commercial speech component, but I have a lot of trouble with the following ad, with following kinds of ads that you see, I see in Florida when I'm traveling at turnpike speed, these huge ads. Sometimes they come down when the rules have been changed, then they come back and it says there's some very smiling people, even though they've been in a horrible accident of some kind, but now they've settled the case. And it says, Dan Newlin got me $450,000. Now, factually, that's no doubt true. It may be distasteful because they're smiling, but yet something was awful. But the reason why even I, a First Amendment proponent, think this might be misleading is what if it's literally true that Dan Newlin got them $450,000, but it was a $4 million case and he blew it completely? How do we know that that's true? So I think there should be, you know, there is room for more tweaking on that. Finally, one more thing. Last year, April followed up with one other set of recommendations, and that is it tweaked the solicitation rules a little bit to make it more clear that it's not merely real time, but it's the in-person and live phone that is the turning point. So, and they did that because there had been several regulations that said, well, an online chat group is really like you're in person, and so that's too coercive, and so we're going to regulate those as well. April's proposal, which I think has a good chance of passing, said, no, a chat group is really just like a letter. You can toss it in the trash for a letter, and the Supreme Court has said those are not solicitations, those are advertisements. And by the same token, if you don't like what's going on in a chat group, you just hit the conclude button and you're out. So let me get out and turn it back over to John.
Thank you, Bill. My second topic is some recent developments in attorney's fees. And the last 12 months have been very busy from the ABA Ethics Opinion Writing Committee, where they've issued 3 ethics opinions dealing with attorney's fees. And I thought I'd go through them and then talk about one recent state opinion that also addresses fees. The most recent opinion, 476, addresses the question of how lawyers should withdraw when a client fails to pay the fee. Now, under Model Rule 116, the withdrawal rule, when a client fails to fulfill an obligation to a lawyer, including a payment of a fee or keeping up the funds or a deposit for expenses, a lawyer, of course, can take the route to withdraw. Model Rule 116B5 requires that you give notice specifically to the client that you'll withdraw unless they fulfill that obligation. We usually teach that as, you know, your first bill goes out and you give your client either 15 or 30 days to pay the bill, and if they don't pay it, you've got to give them another notice saying, if you don't pay this, I'm going to withdraw. So often it might be viewed as a two period notice, 2-15 day or 2-30 day notices. If the client comes up with the money, even on the very last day, it's very difficult for the lawyer to withdraw. And of course, that's because in part, clients invest in a lawyer and changing midstream is more difficult, especially if it involves litigation. The whole idea that sometimes clients are in litigation because they don't have the resources. And so, this idea of the notice is put in there to protect clients. This opinion addresses what happens if you're in litigation and you have to ask a judge for permission to withdraw. The opinion really pushes the notion that lawyers need to be mindful that if they say too much, they really hurt the client. So in withdrawing, lawyers should only say what is necessary in a motion or to the court in an open hearing, and understand that specific details could be significantly injurious of the client's legal or negotiating position in the ongoing lawsuit. The opinion addresses the duty of the lawyers to consider that, but it also talks about judges should balance their need to know and the rights of the client. So they shouldn't be unduly pressing clients and lawyers, hey, I really want to know. I want to know why you want to withdraw. Now, in withdrawing, judges often won't allow it at a very late date. Obviously, during trial or on the eve of trial, judges also often want to know about substitute counsel. They want to know about delays. And there are a lot of judicial aspects. There are a lot of reasons why a judge might be hesitant. But this idea of disclosing too much about the interaction of the lawyer with the client is the focus of this opinion. The opinion also addresses the idea that if you need to disclose sensitive information, the avenue might be to ask that it be done in camera. So with the filing to include material that's blacked out, material that then is reviewed in camera privately outside the opposing counsel with the judge. So the filing would have redacted information and the judge could hear the reasons in chambers. Of course, this opinion is only as powerful as judges sort of heed this advice or look at some of the considerations. There were some opinions listed in this ethics opinion that gave examples of lawyers going too far and really hurting clients on these motions to withdraw. And I think the ABA thought that it was an important point to educate lawyers and judges on this whole topic. Another opinion in December 2016, opinion 475, talked about the idea of what happens when several law firms are involved in a representation and one law firm gets dollars to distribute. And there's another lawyer or another law firm in that distribution chain. Now, this is a new reality with many clients. Clients that used to have one law firm do all of their work are combining law firms and not doing it just based on topic, but also doing it based on specialty. So within a deal, you might have a law firm dealing with the tax, you might have a law firm dealing with the securities, and you might have a law firm dealing with the international implications of a particular transaction. Model Rule 1.1 and 1.2 in comments talk about when that happens, lawyers need to be sure that they address the scope of what each firm is responsible for. And sometimes there'll be a lead firm, and sometimes there'll be sort of co-equal firms. And even in the co-equal example, it's important to know who's really responsible for receiving the funds, if there are funds involved, who's responsible for putting them in escrow. Now, opinion 475 takes the idea that when you are dividing or sharing legal fees with lawyers not in the same firm, you have to follow 15E. And that needs to be done under the ABA position, either based on a division of work performed or joint responsibility. And the client needs to be informed specifically about the amounts each lawyer is receiving and needs to consent to it, and the total fee needs to be reasonable. In this situation, a law firm is receiving the funds and then has funds owed to a third-party law firm, another law firm that did work on it. And, of course, the law firm receiving the funds needs to be sure that it follows the 15E division of fees in lawyers in different firms, but also has obligations under 115, holding client property. And in that instance, of course, they have a right to notify the other law firm. They have a duty to put it in a trust account and to promptly deliver it. If it's a contingent fee, there needs to be an accounting. If it's a fixed fee, it's an accounting upon request. And so this is clarifying the idea of how you safeguard the legal fees of other lawyers involved in the representation. Now, in essence, this implicitly says don't give all the money to the client and say, client, pay the other law firm. You have an obligation because if you know of this division of fees. This is also formalizing just the reality of multiple law firms involved in representing clients in one case. And this opinion is just clarifying the application of those rules, 15 and 115, to how this works out in practice. The third ethics opinion issued in April of 2016 involves referral fees when the referring lawyer has a conflict of interest and how that works. Now, in a state like Texas, and Texas is in the minority of the referral fee area where pure referral fees were permitted for a long period of time. The five states that allowed pure referral fees addressed this issue a long time ago, because if the referring lawyer has a conflict, there are ethics opinions in those five states that talk about if you are conflicted from the case and you send it to someone else, you can't keep a 1% interest in that case that's now held by lawyer two, because you were prohibited from representing the client in the first place due to the conflict. Now, in the ABA opinion, they address the idea that you might be involved in getting a referral fee based on joint responsibility, or you might be involved based on division of work. And either of those two 15E sort of avenues for taking a referral fee, the opinion makes it clear for you to get the fee, you have to follow the general conflicts rule. And if you had a particular conflict or a potential conflict, you might be able to resolve that through client consent and full disclosure, but you can't take the fee unless you resolve it through 17B. And they give several hypotheticals. They talk about an accident of a flower shop worker where you represent the flower shop, and it was done on the accident on the flower shop worker's own time, and they go through scenarios where there's no conflict, there's a potential conflict, there's an actual conflict. And they talk about the idea of to get the fee from 15E, you have to work through the conflicts rule of 17B and get the client's consent and meet the other requirements of that conflicts rule. It's interesting that this has become a problem. Obviously, lawyers in ABA jurisdiction, the 45 states, are probably taking more referral fees these days, and that sometimes the referral occurs because of a potential conflict, that maybe there's someone involved on the other side that they would rather not sue or be adverse to. But this is a fascinating sort of intersection between conflicts and the fees rule. The last topic is the idea of law firms accepting digital currency, bitcoins, as compensation for a fee. And the ABA-BNA manual had two articles in September. One of them was a lot of technology law firms representing high-tech clients have been accepting bitcoins for years, 2, 3, 4 years. And many traditional law firms are now starting to do it. And I think they mentioned Steptoe and Johnson in that article. They also highlight a Nebraska ethics opinion, September 2017, opinion 1703, that addresses some of the risks and issues in bitcoins. Now, bitcoins are a digital currency that has gained some acceptance in the common world where people talk about that, and in fact, some people invest in it. It is a cryptocurrency, so it is based upon a mathematical program that gives it value and uniqueness. There are a finite number of bitcoins on the marketplace, and they can be subdivided. And the beauty of this cryptocurrency or digital currency is that it avoids many of the historical transaction costs that banks might have, both in terms of currency conversion, in terms of wiring, in terms of processing transactions. Some of the negatives involve the risk, where this currency fluctuates significantly, and it might fluctuate up and down far more than another a historical hard currency associated with a government. Because of the fluctuation, the Nebraska opinion says lawyers must convert it to a traditional currency immediately. They cannot hold it or speculate it, and that is an important feature. And obviously, when they hold it, it's property. It's not like a fund. So it's not in an account, even though it is theoretically in a Bitcoin account. It's property that needs to be converted and then deposited in a trust account. Another issue is that because of the decentralized nature of cryptocurrencies, they are transferred anonymously. So the law firm needs to know the identity of the client or the source of payment. Possibly there are third-party payment implications, and that's another feature that you wouldn't think of when you think of a Bitcoin. So the acceptance, storage, and conversion of Bitcoins presents a lot of challenges for law firms. Some of them are doing it, I think, to be trendy. Some of them are doing it because their clients don't have any other kind of currency, and so they're seeking to open up new avenues of business. So I'll go ahead and finish and turn it over to Bill, and we'll have some questions and answers after Bill's session.
My second topic is ethical, the electronic age, and it has some serious overlap with my first talk, because one of the significant problems that April's task force found with the existing advertising regulations was the difficulty and inappropriateness of applying detailed and already suspect, as I've mentioned, regulations to online advertising and blogs and law firm websites and LinkedIn and all of those things that might help make a connection with potential clients. That just exacerbated the problem. And in addition, the fact that electronics websites and all of those did not respect state boundary lines, that also brings in John's first topic as well. But the focus here in my second topic is what are generally referred to as social media, and less with explicit advertising moves. Now, before jumping into some examples, I just want to give a disclaimer of bias in case it seems that I'm biased when you hear the examples that I've picked. I personally am not on Facebook, I'm not on Twitter, I'm not on LinkedIn, I don't know how to use any of those. I don't use anything except email, the April chat group, a couple of other political chat forums, and my own, and this is really a political view, I think Facebook and Twitter in particular, are bad influences on society. Those people who are friending you are not your friends. I don't care what people are doing when they're Twittering me as to what they're doing. And I myself decline every request that I ever get, whether it's from my son, my brother, anyone else. But beyond the advertising aspect of, as I say, on websites and people, particularly bigger law firms now, send out materials. Many lawyers are heavily into these forms of communications and use them both for contacting clients and professional contacts, but also in their personal lives. And so sometimes it gets too easy, in my view, my bias again, to you get so accustomed to doing one or the other that you don't realize when you're melding from one to the other, you can get in trouble. So a subtitle for this topic could be something like, if you're going to screw up anyway, you will probably screw up worse on social media. And here's a good first example. In the Garrison case from Nebraska, which is in the materials, it was just a couple of months, it was this year, I think February, March. The lawyer in that case, Garrison, used Facebook to keep his client informed. Clients could Facebook into him and he could Facebook back and so on about the progress of the case and what was going on. But I put that in quote, the keep informed part, because what he actually did was he used Facebook to blow the client off, to make flip remarks, to discourage further inquiry. The client would say, well, what's going on? And he'd say, oh, you know, I'd have to write you a book. I'm busy now. You know, go away. Don't worry about it. I'm taking control of it. So my take, to go back to my possible subtitle, is that this jerk of a lawyer probably would have found other ways to be a jerk if we didn't have social media, but why make it effortless to mouth off? But if you are going to, you know, have all these things, just be extra careful that it's so easy because people are more and more accustomed to using social media that you have to be careful that when you're wearing your lawyer hat, you certain obligations that you have to communicate with a client properly and so on, and not mouth off. Speaking of mouthing off, by the way, this was in last year's CLE. One of the full units I did was on a single case, In Re McCool, a 2015 case from Louisiana, in which a lawyer involved in a contentious child custody matter in two different states used online petitions, used her blog, use social media to gin up an extraordinary pressure campaign urging her readers or followers to directly petition and call the chambers of the judges involved all the way up to the Louisiana Supreme Court. And ultimately, she was disbarred for that misconduct, probably because she was unrepentant all the way up through oral argument in the Louisiana Supreme Court and claimed a version of the First Amendment that none of us would recognize, I think, which was basically, I'm a lawyer, this involves important public issues, so I can say whatever the hell I want, whenever I want, even if I'm attacking judges. Now, one significant problem in all of today's electronic communications issues is the inadvertent leaking of confidential information. Sorry, let me get rid of that. I should be okay. and that can be through the safeguard, there are many opinions on this as well, can be through hacking, which is extremely rare, sending a communication to the wrong address, which is fairly rare, but a more common form is just through carelessness in what is put out into the ether deliberately. There was a Wisconsin bar ethics opinion earlier this year stated that it is simply improper, it is improper simply to list clients the way a lot of law firms do on their website or in other less formal electronic communications unless the client has consented. Now, everything that's revealed may be totally innocuous. You're not giving away the crown jewels or anything, but the burden of proof, this opinion quite rightly points out, that the burden of proof on confidentiality is the other way. No name dropping, whether it's online, whether it's in a cocktail party, whatever it is, no name dropping or other disclosure of interesting, not particularly harmful, but non-public information unless the client consents first. Finally, there have been a number of cases in which lawyers and judges and some combinations of parties or witnesses have been found to have been friends or followers, I guess, in Twitter in the non-court world, and it comes back to haunt them in the in-court world. Now, often there is no big deal, no disqualification, but a tremendous amount of time and resources is wasted in dealing with this, and it, to me, it's just an unnecessary expense that you just should not be involved in these kinds of activities. An outstanding example occurred just recently, I think this month or last month, in a case called United States versus Sierra Pacific Industries in the Ninth Circuit. There was a huge settlement in a major forest fire case in the West about who was responsible and was negligent. The settlement of millions and millions of dollars was jeopardized because the federal district court judge handling the case and handling the settlement 2 or 3 years earlier had a Twitter account under a pseudonym that was being followed, it turned out, by several attorneys in the U.S. Attorney's Office that was handling the case. Probably they didn't know for sure that it was this judge and so on. The judge refused to set aside the settlement when the other side recognized, the timber company recognized this. The judge refused to set aside the settlement, refused to disqualify himself, but it went all the way to a full briefing and a full opinion in the Ninth Circuit. Absolute total waste of time and money for nothing. So that's my definitely biased object lesson. So I'm going to ring off and then we can get some questions. I'm going to take out my earpiece and see if I can just listen directly on phone now.
Great. Let's go to audience question and answer. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Let's go to our first caller.
Hello, this is Ken Cuccinelli. I appreciate y'all's presentation. I have a question in the electronic age section of what you're going through here. What are your thoughts on, say, a law firm that wants to do a webinar for its clients? What is the law firm's responsibility, one, to confirm that the only people on are its clients, and two, to confirm, if you want to do a more general presentation that isn't legal advice, to confirm that you only have people from states in which you're barred, or do you have any obligation to do that at all? Thank you.
Well, I think the first one is easy because I think the technology is fairly easy in effect, just as this one is, to password it or have call-in numbers that is only handed out to the people you want it to be handed out to. Federalists in this particular federal society, because people are getting CLE credit, so they only, you know, only if they've signed in can they get it. And I think you could do the same for clients or anybody else if you wanted to, if it was as long as you were sure that it wasn't going to be misused. There was client information. With respect to the out-of-state problem, that is indeed the kind of problem that, you know, and you could add a long litany of where people just can't do what they want to do because everything would run into, and it's sort of a combination of my topic and John's first topic, would be seen as, my God, you're sitting there in, I think you said LA, I'm talking into an electronic device, but I'm giving legal advice. Now, it might just be general legal advice, not, you know, not case specific, so it might be okay, but I'm giving it that's going out over the ether to all of these heathens in New York where I'm not licensed. Does that count as practicing law in New York or not? That's one of the reasons why the communications aspect so dovetails with the interstate authorized practice across state lines issue. What, how do you think that would be resolved nowadays, John, as it stands right now?
There is some authority on the First Amendment side to give presentations, but of course that authority was all done in the day of people hold a seminar, people hold a meeting, and people can show up in person, and of course you assume that people are showing up or have a problem within that state. I think the First Amendment is helpful here. I think the idea that UPL issues can be handled the way often people handle them on these radio talk shows, you know, when they're ask a lawyer. You know, I'm giving you kind of the general landscape, but if you're, you know, I'm licensed in the following state or my firm is licensed in the following states, but it certainly is an issue. I mean, you could see somebody taking the webinar and bringing up, you know, those problems of UPL and advertising.
Right. I would just add that I was going to make the same point about the radio shows. I think that's one way to handle the UPL issue and cross state lines, and also the advertising or even competence issues within your own state. And that was true before electronics. And that is indeed make sure that, this was advice we've been given for years, that in a CLE setting, make sure that you refuse to answer very clearly case-specific issues, because that's legal advice. And although the First Amendment protects it to some extent, it doesn't protect it anywhere near the way that, you know, temporarily assuming the role of a professor, even though you don't have the title of a professor, you're teaching in a public forum. And I think that should be, if you're careful enough to make disclaimers as the radio guys do all the time. Now, this is not legal advice for specific. I'm just making a general discussion of it. Should be okay.
Let's go to our next question.
Ma'am, I hate to be this specific, but is there a way to get an audio captcha for sign-in purposes?
Say again?
Is there a way to get an audio captcha for sign-in purposes?
If that's a question about how to get ethics CLE credit for this teleform, please email info@fedsoc.org after the call. Again, to
okay,
ask a
question. Okay, I'm glad you could answer that. I didn't.
Yeah. To ask a question about the content of this call, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. just a reminder about upcoming telephone calls. Our next call is scheduled for Monday, October 2nd at 2 p.m. That will be a special Courthouse Steps call with Edward F. Burberry, shareholder at Littler & Mendelson, to discuss the oral argument of the National Labor Relations Board v. Murphy Oil USA, which will have taken place earlier that day. Let's go to our next audience question.
Hey, this is a question regarding attorney's fees and Bitcoin. And I might be asking you to repeat something you did say, which I didn't quite catch. But is the obligation to turn Bitcoin into local currency only with regard to Bitcoins received and to be held in trust, or does that also apply to Bitcoins received as compensation for fees?
So the Nebraska opinion, the way it seemed to pose the question is that the law firm had stated its fee in a traditional currency, let's say dollars. So you owe $25,000 for this representation or $500 an hour, and that was being satisfied through Bitcoins. And so the idea was that when you received it, to convert it immediately into dollars, because by holding it in a fluctuation position, you are speculating at the client's risk, because they owe you the $25,000, and if Bitcoins go down when you end up converting it, and they suggested that that could make your fee an unreasonable fee. So if the Bitcoins, let's say, decline by 50%, and you get double the number, that it imposed an unreasonable fee upon the client. So I think it would apply in both circumstances, but I think that's the way the Nebraska opinion posed the question.
Could I just push back on that for a moment, John?
Yeah, please go ahead.
Wouldn't it be so, not on you, but on Nebraska, but wouldn't it be so that if it was paid, as the caller said, in Bitcoin, it would go into the law firm's Bitcoin account and as a certain number of Bitcoins, wouldn't it be at this point they own it and so they're the ones that are now bearing either the risk or the reward?
The Nebraska opinion poses that as you're holding client property, not funds, and the Bitcoin is the client property.
If it's a deposit, yeah. Not a paid on account.
Yeah, but I think you're right. Yeah. If you negotiated with a tech company for 20 Bitcoins, we'll do this representation, and they send you the Bitcoins, then it's your property. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe the distinction is between a deposit and fees paid to, they're done. Here is our payment.
That's right. They're done once they transfer it.
It looks like we might be up on our time here. Would either of you like to make some closing remarks?
No, I think we're good. But I did want to – do you have to give people a second code?
Yes, I was going to do that after closing remarks.
Yeah. Do you have anything, John?
So I was going to just say, Bill's comments on April's work are very important, and the ABA is considering those, and I urge those of you with involvement in the ABA, the advertising rules have long needed to be revised, and it's a very interesting and important development that April's made some headway, and I think, we're in the dark ages, and that a simple approach through a comprehensive one standard, I think, would be very exciting to see.
Also, that is the most likely to be a constitutional approach that's not going to be whack-a-mole all the time, so that you keep on having they change the rules and then the federal court strike them down. They're likely to stand up more because a lot of the Mickey Mouse will go away.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.